We set out a few weeks ago, 10 or 12 weeks ago, actually, to do a study that would allow us to consider the development of the Bible itself, and then how it comes to us over the span of the centuries, and how it comes to us from two different languages now to our language. And our purpose in doing this, if you remember, was to say that here we are living at a time when we have people not attacking the Bible and trying to destroy it as much as discrediting the Bible and trying to ignore it, I think is much better description of the situation we're in. And we want to be able, when someone says, well, the Bible is just a book of men, or some kind of a church or another formed it, or it's changed so much over the years that it doesn't mean the same thing now, or it's been corrupted and so forth, we want to be in a position to keep our faith strong in the middle of that, and second, to be able to answer it if we're given the opportunity to do so. And so I hope the study has not been too frustrating to you. It's not my style. It's not how I normally would like to go about it, but I think it's extremely important. What we did last week is to try to show how between the 1300s and the 1600s, the stage was set for the flourishing of the Bible in English. And we've considered the work of men like John Wycliffe and William Tyndale and Miles Coverdale and so forth, and also the underlying text that they translated into the English language. And we're ready today to get to a place where it's much more familiar to us. And if you'll notice, I've titled this study "The Landmark in the History of the English Bible," and that landmark that has had such influence not only on our understanding of the Bible, but also even in ordinary everyday talk, in the phraseology and the figures of speech and so forth that we use. The arrival of the King James Bible in 1611 has had a profound impact, and not just with the Bible, but on culture. Of the series of translations that had been produced, this one, and there were several, we tried to describe at the end of last week's lesson, is this one is the one that became accepted and popular, and in fact it's described as the most popular and influential English translation ever. And most, I think that's beyond debate. That's how people see it. And for there to be one translation like this that was widely recognized and used for 300 years leading up to now and continues to be widely used and respected, that's quite an achievement. I have a book which lists all the English versions that have been translated since then, and it takes 3 pages to list them all. Now, many of them are parts of the Bible, like the Gospels or the Psalms or whatever, not the whole thing. But the fact that the King James Version of the Bible is still as accepted and highly regarded as it is, tells you something about its lasting influence. Now, what I want to do today is kind of describe it so we can understand the influence it's had and how it ought to be regarded. Really, the King James Bible is the product of a peacemaking effort. And if you notice, last week when we were talking, we tried to point out that the Great Bible, so-called because of its size, was the one that was duly authorized, shall we say, by the Church of England at the time. And it's the one that maybe was to be read in churches, read by the official religious leaders and so forth. The Geneva Bible, however, was the work of Puritans in who had refugees in Switzerland and so forth. It was the one that was more popular with the people and was read in the common in homes wherever it could be gotten. The Church of England came out with the Bishop's Bible as a sort of an update of the Great Bible and to win the competition with the Geneva Bible. It really didn't get the job done, and so here you get to the time when King James I comes to power in 1603, 1604, and he has these competing factions. He was from Scotland himself, and that probably didn't help any, but he has these competing factions, and each of them with their favorite Bibles and so forth, making it worse. And so he convenes a meeting of religious leaders at Hampton Court. And during that meeting, it was suggested that a new translation be made of the whole Bible, as consonant as can be to the original Hebrew and Greek without any marginal notes. And before I go on, let me just point out the marginal notes is what led to the problem with a lot of this, because the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible by the Puritans were objected to the ways of the king and his official church. And the marginal notes in the Bishop's Bible responded to those with their own kind of harsh comments, which you can see where we're headed. It's like having a Bible with a commentary in the margins that attacks your enemies and promote your favorite deal. The King James Bible was to be done as a translation without notes, and that it was to be only to be used in all the churches of England and in time of divine service. The king agreed to that proposal. The project started the next year, 1604. In 1611, the first edition of this the King James Bible came out. I have a reproduction of it in the office I meant to bring in here, and I forgot. Maybe next week we can remember that. And then many editions of this were done. It was revised in 1615, 1629, 38, and then 1762, for example. Spelling corrections, typos, and that kind of thing were corrected, and the wording was updated with each of those revisions. A lot of people don't realize that. All you have to do is to look at what the 1611 one was like to realize the kind of updating that's been done over time. Now, here's what I want for us to understand for the process of Bible translation. It was the manner in which this English version was done that made it unique and caused it to have a lasting influence. You know, where the others that we've studied about have been done either by individuals or individuals and their assistants or their partners, this one was done in a way that involved a number of people, so that individual preferences were not as likely to enter into the what was produced. And that's a huge step here. King James himself organized the translating committee, 54 scholars. Sometimes you'll read 47, but 54 scholars into six teams of translators, six panels who were to translate various parts of Scripture. For example, the first panel was to go from Genesis through the Kings, the next one from 1 Chronicles through Ecclesiastes, the next one from Isaiah to Malachi, the next one first part to the New Testament and so forth. That's how they went about it. And then each panel was to have two members who would serve on a final board that would reconcile all the ideas that were suggested or that were offered. And I've described here for us some of the rules. There were like 15 or so rules, and I've boiled them down here to just a few if you're following on your outline and want to underline any of these ideas. The rules, notice this one carefully. This is at the bottom of page 1 on that number 11 outline. The rules made it clear that this translation was to be a revision. Did you realize that when you read the King James, that it itself is a revision? And it said that the revision was to be minimal. The bishop's Bible was to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. Is the assignment given to these men. The rules called for each company to go through the portions that group was assigned. They were to make any alterations of the bishop's Bible that their consultation of the Greek and Hebrew or Hebrew required, or showed that word required. And then the whole company was to go over these, and then the decisions that were made at that point were to be reconsidered by the whole group. In other words, there were four screenings built into this process of translating from the original text into English. And if you see what we're saying, there are four screenings by different groups or parts of the group, that would tend to refine this and to produce a high quality result. If agreement could not be reached, then a final decision was to be made by the appointed representatives of these groups. Here's another part of this. The old ecclesiastical words were to be retained. And this is an important point I'd like you to see. Words like ecclesiastical, like church or bishop instead of overseer, or some, you know, phrases like that. If you can think of why that might have been, in a group that was mostly the Church of England, then you can see that there is also built into this process the possibility of some bias, and there'd be no marginal notes except indications of parallel passages or different wordings or so forth, and that would cut down the strife that we've talked about. Now, look at 5 and 6 there under this section. Whenever William Tyndale's work, or the Matthew's Bible, or Coverdale's, or the Great Bible, or the Geneva Translation agreed with the original better than the Bishop's Bible, then they were to be used. And notice this point. It turned out that an estimated 90% of the King James Bible retained the wording of William Tyndale's translation. And I don't think most people recognize what an impact Tyndale had. And here's the title page, and I've used even the original spelling here with this to describe the process that had been followed. Look at it. The Holy Bible, containing the Old Testament and the New, newly translated out of the original tongues, and with the former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special commandment, appointed to be read in churches. And the part that I'm wanting you to see there is the understanding that they had that the former translations were being diligently compared and revised. And the concept here that I'm trying to illustrate for us is that there is a process that goes on here with Wycliffe in the 1300s to Tyndale in the 1500s to to Coverdale and Matthews and so forth, and that each of these is not, in English, is, while it's a new translation, it's not a new start that completely tosses out the window everything that's gone on before. Wisdom would not, I don't think wisdom would do that. Wisdom still wouldn't just simply toss out everything that has ever been done as if our generation is the first one to ever know anything. And that's not how the English Bible has developed either, Brother Feeney.
One of the things to remind us is that the King James Version didn't have access to two of the best translations.
That's right.
Old translations.
That's right. I have pointed that out a little bit later in this outline, but that's an important thing. They were using what they had at the time. And I tried to show last week that while the underlying text that they used came to be called the received text, that term was not even used until 13 years after, or 20 years after the King James Bible came out. The first of the older manuscripts, the Alexandrinus, was not given to King James until 1624, which is after, of course, 1611, obviously, Linda.
So, was it cheaper? Was King James translation supposed to be cheaper and more for the common person? Is that why it's gelled and evolves?
It was supposed to be the cost came more because of the development of printing. I mean, printing made it available over time much more reasonably, but it was supposed to be done in the language of the common man, as we'll see in just a minute. Not in official, not like the Catholic Church did with Latin, for keeping it, or not just for scholars, or it was supposed to be so that an ordinary person could read the Bible in his own language and know what God was saying. That was the idea. And in fact, your questions here are somewhat answered by this next section, if you'll think about this. I have a copy of this also in the office I meant to bring, from the Translators to the Reader. It was a preface to the King James Bible that was prepared by one of the members of the committee, Dr. Miles Smith, and it explained some things about their thinking of what they were doing that really is helpful and is thought-provoking. You ought to read the whole thing. It's several pages long. It used to be printed in editions of the King James Bible, but it seldom is now. I don't think I've ever seen it other than this book form. Smith said on behalf of the group, look at this, we never thought, and I've updated the spelling, or it would look a lot different here. We never thought from the beginning that we should make a new translation, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal one, not to be justly accepted against. That has been our endeavor, that our mark. In other words, put that in your own language. We wanted to present a translation of the Bible that could not be out of hand ignored. I mean, that's how I would say that. That's what they're saying. And they didn't regard all the works that had gone before them as failures. They were looking to use them to make a better one. Now, here's something about their thinking to be helpful to you, I believe. The translators believed two things about the Bible. They believed that every person had the responsibility of reading it for themselves, and they saw their work as making that task possible for everybody. And here's excerpts of their statement. The Scriptures then, being acknowledged to be so full and so perfect, how can we excuse ourselves of negligence if we do not study them? Notice the high regard in which these translators held the Scriptures. But how shall men meditate in that which they cannot understand? And I like the figure of speech they've used here. Indeed, without hesitation, in the vulgar tongue, vulgar, remember, in Old English meant common or ordinary, not low or dirty like it does today. And isn't it interesting that just the term used to describe the language has itself changed meaning over the years? Into the vulgar tongue, the unlearned, without hesitation, in the vulgar tongue, the unlearned are but like children at Jacob's well, without a bucket or something to draw with. Have you ever felt like that? I have a lot of times. Now what can be more available thereto than to deliver God's book unto God's people in a tongue they can understand? That was a well-said phrase. So you can see what they saw themselves as trying to do. Now, notice also, they didn't claim that their work would never need to be corrected, improved, or updated. In other words, they didn't see themselves as producing the end-all translation. Smith wrote that there was no cause, therefore, why the word translated should be denied to the word, that should be the world, notwithstanding that some imperfections and blemishes may be noted in the setting forth of it. Now, what that means is the fact that uninspired translators are translating the inspired word, and that the translators will have their weaknesses, that does not mean that an individual cannot take a translation and read God's word and understand it. What they're saying is no one should excuse himself from responsibility to God's word on the ground that the translators made mistakes or whatever. That's the thought that they're getting at. They believe that the English Bible should be kept current with the language and the scholarship of the day, and they said this: a blessed thing it is, and will bring us into everlasting blessedness in the end, when God speaks unto us to hearken, when he sets his word before us to read it. In other words, to listen to him and to pay attention to him. Now, here's where we take a minute to look at the product of their work. And I've tried to be fair in the things that I've included here, and you can offer some examples of this. Here are some of the impressive strengths, and I've just some of them. There are a lot of strengths that this version had. Its style has a simplicity and a majesty about it, which makes it not just a good translation of the Bible, but also one of the greatest literary works ever. Where would the world be, for example, without the King James Version's translation of Psalm 23? There still are very few things quite that moving. Or with the translation of the Beatitudes, or that kind of thing. And a second strength is the King James Version was for reading out loud. When it's read out loud, it has a certain rhythm to it, which is matchless and memorable. And here's what I catch myself doing, and see if Brother Feeney, if you're like this too, but I catch myself, I use the English Standard Version usually in my study, but when I am quoting something,
you go to the King James.
Why is that, do you think?
Because you memorized it.
I memorized it, and it was done in a way that was memorable. It has a rhythm about it that sticks in your memory, and that's a great strength. And then many of its picturesque statements serve so well that they showed up in common usage in everyday English language. Some of the words and phrases from the King James, I didn't make a list of them here. I should have thought to do that. Brother Feeney?
I used it because I memorized in that, mm-hmm. but also in 30 states that I've held meetings, I've never found a Church of Christ that didn't have the King James in the pulpit seats in the pews.
There are.
They use that pretty well as standard.
Yes, yes, and where it was generally, people knew the Bible too. So, can you guys think of other strengths of the King James Bible that you think should be mentioned that I haven't here or haven't thought to include here?
When you go into homes to study, you're going to find the King James translation.
A lot of times you will. It's not always the case with people now who are not familiar with the Bible, but a lot of times. Burl, was it you had a hand?
Somewhere I read where, on average, isn't the words that are contained in the Bible not more than about half a dozen letters or something on average?
Yes, yes, that's a very good point. It succeeded in putting it at a level where a person without a great deal of education could read it at the time. Now, we'll comment more about that in just a second. That's a very good point. The fact that it's lasted, I mentioned earlier, but that's one of the things about it. It's been a great strength. Anything else? I mean, you could, Brother Feeney mentioned 30 states, but you could go wherever the English Bible was known and communicate with somebody in that way too. Norma?
I remember Barney's class when I was in the average home had 13 Bibles. I went home, I thought the Bible was counting true. And I went home, and I did have. I honestly did have. But, you know, they weren't the same shape.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
were all...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad about two things. I'm glad you have 13 Bibles, and I'm glad you checked Barney out.
Oh,
but you know, if you compare what happened to these two men with the ready availability of the Bible in most of our lives, just think of how blessed we are. Just think of how blessed we are. All right, now move to the next section with me. This is the part where we get into some of the study that needs to be thought about too. The King James Bible, like these others, what happened to this man? Remember, he ended up, this one was burned at the stake. This one ended up having his bones dug up and burned into ashes and thrown into the river. This one was strangled and burned at the stake. And there's some of these others who had that same thing happen to them. Where translation of the Bible has been done, criticism has tended to result. And it did with the translation of the King James Version too. Now we accept it and criticize other versions, but it was criticized heavily when it appeared. Thomas Fuller said some of the brethren were not well pleased with this translation. It was an understatement. Hugh Broughton said it was so poorly done that it would grieve him as long as he lived. He insisted that he'd rather be tied between wild horses and torn apart than to let it go forth to the people. One of the lessons I get from that is that, you know, be careful about just saying, I like this one, I don't like that one. These translations have strengths and weaknesses, and they need to be understood that way. The Catholics made fun of it and asked if the Anglicans' translation was not good before, and if it was good before, why did it have to be amended now? Lightfoot and others objected that the Apocrypha was included, and it was included up until the 19th century. First time the King James came out without the Apocrypha being included was in the 19th century. Only the passing of time, I've pointed out, brought the privileged status to it that it ended up having. Now, here are some of the legitimate weaknesses. Not every criticism are justified, but some of the legitimate weaknesses, and however much you admire it, don't just act like that there were none of these. There were various editions of it, of course, and some of them had printer's errors that needed to be corrected. And that doesn't mean the translation was bad. It just means that repeated editions did come out. I brought some examples of some of these printing mistakes that were made. In one edition, the not was left out of the seventh commandment, leaving it to say, "Thou shalt commit adultery." That edition came to be known as the Wicked Bible for obvious reasons. A 1612 edition misprints princes in Psalm 119, 161 and reads, "Printers have persecuted me without cause." In one edition, in 1 Corinthians 6, 9, this is called the Unrighteous Bible. It says that the unrighteous shall inherit the kingdom, and so on. In other words, just that type of thing, because it's work done by people. Those weaknesses are there in some cases. The King James is a freer translation than most people realize. And what I mean by that is the translators did not uniformly translate certain Greek or Hebrew words with certain English words. They used a variety of English words. And of course, that's not something that ruins it, because if you think about it, if you look at an English word in a dictionary, any English word just about, it'll give you, here will be this word, and then it will say it means this, this, this. It'll give you some synonyms. And the King James translators realized that, and they used a variety of English terms to translate one Greek word or Hebrew word in different contexts. And so it makes it difficult for the reader to realize that these same terms are being used sometimes in his study. In some cases, terms were not actually translated because it was unpopular with the Church of England. They were transliterated. Can you give me an idea or an example of that?
Baptism.
Baptism would be the best example of this. Baptize means to immerse or to dip or to plunge. Why did it not get translated?
All right. Church of England group.
That's right, because the sprinkling process that sometimes went on. There are other examples of that too. The word Easter gets used in Acts 12 and verse 4 for a term that everywhere else is translated Passover. That might indicate maybe a little bit of bias that entered into the picture. And then, of course, the language continued to change, as language does over time, and it's interesting to point out that maybe the King James language may not be open to the very vulgar as they meant for it to be. And I brought with me just a few examples of this also that I might point out here. You can find all kinds of examples like this in your study, but words like wot, I wot not, W-O-T, or some form of that, prevent, in the King James Version, we say now precede. A couple of prevent means to keep somebody from it, but the word means to precede. Conversation in the King James Version means not talk, but behavior. In Isaiah 2 and verse 9, it talks in Proverbs 22:29 uses the phrase "mean man," and it means a common man. So just some things like that peculiar means not something odd or different, but something that belongs especially to someone. Just simple illustrations like that, that anybody familiar with having studied the Bible and the King James Version would know and understand, but the common person might not. He might have to have it translated to him, in other words. Now, what Brother Feeney mentioned, we've already commented on here a little bit, so I won't take the time to do it more, but the texts that underlay the King James translation were more recent texts and not the older ones that were discovered later. They didn't have the benefit of archaeological studies and that kind of thing. Now, that all those discoveries did not change the text in great ways, but in some ways they did. And I point out on your paper here that just as the King James Bible was a revision of English versions that preceded it, subsequent translations have appeared which claim at least to be revisions of the King James Version. And I've listed three of these here, and then several examples under C. And notice the statement at the bottom of that page there. We'll look into some of these here in the next 2 weeks. We'll just take a couple more weeks to finish this little survey that we've been involved in. Kind of to sum it up here, the King James Version was a great, great step forward that has had a huge influence on the understanding of the Bible. But it was a revision of people who made great, of the work of people who made great sacrifices, and it has been updated in ways that fit language and the study of the original text. And whether improvements have been made or not, you have to decide that. I'm trying to describe to you how the process happened, and I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you very much for being with us today. A couple more of these, and we'll finish this quarter and get back into the study of the Bible itself. Thank you for being with us.